Welcome to the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. If your job involves working with or influencing people's behavior, this podcast offers invaluable insights into what makes people tick. Through personal interviews that are thoughtful and surprising, we explore the full range of the roots to people smarts that can help you make or break your own career. My name is Marie Gervais, and with a PhD in culture and learning in the workplace and my own cultural journey, I bring the mysteries of human beings at work around the world to you. Through conversations with very diverse people, examining the groups they were born into and the ones they chose to belong to, my podcast takes a deep dive into why people do what they do and how they belong. Hone your skills to manage others and to be a better human being at work with the Culture and Leadership Connections podcast. And now for today's episode. Hello, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Today, I have a most wonderful guest for you. His name is Dan Barker, and he is a leadership expert and Indigenous advocate and founder of IDA Leadership Lab. I'll tell you a lot more about him, but before that, I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are on the traditional lands referred to as Treaty 6 territory, and that the City of Edmonton and all the people here are beneficiaries of this peace and friendship treaty. Edmonton is and has been home to a diverse range of Indigenous nations and peoples, including the Cree, Blackfoot, Métis, Nakota Sioux, Iroquois, Dene, Ojibwe, Salto, Anishinaabe, Tsuut'ina, Inuit, and many others. Treaty 6 encompasses the traditional territories of numerous Western Canadian First Nations, as well as the Métis people, who have called this area home since time immemorial. So now I'd like to go with a little bio about Dan and his wonderful work. Dan is an award-winning leadership expert, a senior human resources business partner at Country Supplier, and the founder of IDA Leadership Lab, where he helps teams and businesses transform through innovative results-oriented workshops. With 20 years of leadership, customer service, and business transformation expertise, Dan is certified in multiple assessments, which he can also offer to organizations as tools for growth and success. In addition to his leadership roles, Dan serves as the chairman of the Bonnyville Youth Development Coalition, where he focuses on youth empowerment and community development. And he previously worked as a leadership development manager at T-Mobile, where he chaired diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives that highlighted and supported Indigenous team members, which I'm very interested in asking him more questions about. Dan's passion for advocacy stems from his deep connection to his Native American roots as a member of the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe. He is dedicated to preserving his culture through education and advocacy, supporting Indigenous rights and cultural awareness. His story, rooted in the White Crane Clan and the legacy of Madeline Island, adds a unique perspective to his work as a leadership consultant and speaker. Dan, I'm so honored that you're taking the time for this interview. Welcome.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
So tell the audience a little bit about who you are personally, since the bio gives all your professional qualifications, and a little bit about your heritage and your cultural advocacy. But tell us a little bit about you. You must have grown up somewhere and you had a family. Tell us about that person of Dan Barker.
Sure, yeah. So I'm originally from northern Wisconsin. I was born in a little town called Ashland, which is about 10 miles from the reservation that my tribe is connected to. I'm a twin, so I was born with a brother in 1970s, right, when NICU units were kind of a new thing. So we were rushed, I remember, to a hospital in Duluth when we were young babies and there till we were about 4 weeks old, but eventually moved to Idaho, where I live today. I have lived and worked all over the country, but back in 2020, decided to come back here to where was really the last place I had called home since my childhood. And my wife is from this area as well. I've been married for 21 years. I have two children, a 17-year-old daughter and a 15-year-old son. I love to spend my free time out in the wilderness. I'm an avid winter sports person, so I love to downhill ski and I rec hockey. So those are my fun kind of personal things.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. What about your childhood? Can you share a couple of incidents from your childhood that you believe made you into that person you are today? They might be things that stood out because they were an insight, or maybe they were painful, or maybe they were just really joyful and you like remember them that way. So anything that stands out in your mind would be wonderful.
Yeah. You know, one that I've always talked about is football. I wasn't naturally an aggressive kid. And so I had a friend that kind of was. And I remember there was a summer where he's like, I'm going to sign up for football. And I was like, yeah, me too. So of course, when we went down there, I signed up. I don't even know that I really knew what football was all that much, except for like the brief moments I'd watched it on TV. I think I was around seventh grade, so 12, 13 years old. And football is a pretty physical sport. And so within the first 2 weeks, I was not loving the practices. And finally, and a lot of it came down to the physicality of it. I wasn't really used to beating heads with other guys, or the hard workouts that you have to go through was certainly a new experience for me as well. And 2 weeks in, I walked off and was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And when I got home, my dad was like, you know what? I don't think you're taking into consideration on, you know, what the big picture looks like for you playing this sport. And I think he saw a son that was probably afraid a little bit, but there's an opportunity to teach. And so I remember he dragged me back down to the field, got in a big fight with my coach, which has always been a funny thing with some of the friends that I still have in this area. Ended up getting me back on the team and ended up playing football for about four more seasons after that, like in an offensive line or defensive line position. What I've always said about the moment of not quitting, how much it shaped other things in my life. So I think when you look at like your professional career, there's so many things that you have to overcome. And not just professional, your personal life as well. And so I think that that was a shaping moment to say, you know, like, well, things are going to be tough. And as you approach these tough things, how do you take them head on? And how do you sometimes look at the fact that things are tough or that you are afraid and still make those steps forward?
Yeah.
I've always seen that as a very impactful moment in my life.
Yeah, that's a great story. And shows also the role of your dad in being your advocate and helping you to do the hard thing. So when you advocate for people, sometimes they have to face up to some difficult thing. And sometimes the person advocating has to encourage them. But in this case, he challenged you and then he challenged your coach to make sure you got back on the team and you had a second chance. So it was both encouraging you and then also telling you that, yeah, this was a big picture moment and he wasn't going to let you sidestep it.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Is like if you teach early on, certainly if you teach somebody to quit, especially if they're afraid of something or because something's uncomfortable, what behavior is that going to lead to in their future?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What about when you were an adolescent or a young adult?
You know, I had to move from Idaho Falls to Boise, my junior year of high school. And so I think that it's easy for people to understand, especially in the late 90s, how cliquish high schools were. They are today as well. You know, it's a very cliquish environment. And had I graduated from Idaho Falls High School, which is where I grew up, I would attend a school with like, I think 18 individuals all the way from like kindergarten.
Wow, that's
so
small.
It is small, but also like very, very connected. Even in a community where I sometimes wasn't always an insider, but still was connected with the community itself and the people that I had lived around most of my life. And so that transition to Boise, which is about 300 miles from Idaho Falls to Boise, it's in the same state. But, you know, going to a new high school for your senior year, it was tough to establish relationships. Certainly didn't have the same like cliquish factor. I was a newspaper geek, so there was certainly a group that I could latch onto early on, but it wasn't the same kind of connections or the same group that I hung out with here in the community that I had grown up in. And I think certainly the early days of it were frustrating sometimes, and I think it altered the overall experience from high school as a whole for me. But it did start to kind of build some of the skill set that I have today and some of the behaviors that I use today to establish relationships with people and more value sometimes rapport versus like a deep relationship and understanding that certain relationships you have or certain networks you have for certain reasons. And so I think those early days helped kind of create some of that flexibility in me and really probably a stronger social awareness that I was able to use early on in my career to sometimes make headway or break through barriers.
Mm-hmm. Do you think part of that social awareness came from being Indigenous and being in a non-Indigenous environment?
Definitely. And then even outside of that, I always like a outsider versus insider type of approach. Even when the obvious isn't there as well, then the fact of just in any community, it's certainly easy to be an outsider versus an insider, depending on how they approach diversity, how they accept people, and what they find to be acceptable.
That's true. That's true. If they have a very rigid set of, you know, these three things are required and you don't fit, then it's pretty hard to make inroads.
Yeah, I've grown up in very conservative communities and I come from a very liberal family.
Mm-hmm.
And I say conservative on, yes, you could take the political side of it, but most of it's actually come from a religious side.
Mm-hmm. And so you were in a liberal family. And this is kind of leading to my next question that I wanted to ask you, which is the groups that you were born into would have been your family and also the White Crane Clan and the Bad River Band of the Ojibwe. And then also the communities that you lived in that were conservative, you were kind of born into all of that. So of those groups that you were born into, what would you say has most influenced your sense of culture now?
I certainly think growing up in this area, which is a very religious-based culture here in Idaho, has certainly influenced my view on culture as a whole, but I think it pushed me closer to my indigenous culture. Mm-hmm. Because when you start to realize there's an outsider factor there, you could certainly join in, but does it fit with how your family aligns itself, how you align yourself to your own history, your own heritage? And I think that's the struggles I had early on, was trying to see certainly how Indigenous people have been treated in this area and are still treated sometimes in this area.
Are treated all over the world. I just found out recently about...
Yeah, to be fair, yes.
The Oromo indigenous culture in Ethiopia, which I didn't know about, and how badly they've been treated there. And I knew there were different tribes in Ethiopia, but it didn't hit me that there was an indigenous tribe that's the worst persecuted of everybody. And I thought, wow, every country does the same stupid thing.
Yeah.
They pick the people that are the most necessary to understand the environment in the world that they're living in, and then they persecute them instead of learning from them.
Well, and that weird draw that people are so afraid of the differences that exist among us. And so there's a poll that people would like you to join, the religion that's very prominent in this area. But the reason people jump to it so quickly sometimes is you're part of now that community. There's a sameness, right? We have a like mind. I don't think it's a false thing by any means, but for myself, it certainly came to look at a point where like I felt like I would have to pick one over the other. And so it pushed me closer to my indigenous culture to say like, this is where I come from. This is who I am. And I think even more so, how do I make sure that my kids understand, you know, and they know where they came from, because they're going to continue to grow up and be adults at a time where they also are going to be looking around saying, you know, everybody that's here came from here. Majority of these people came from here. Where did I come from? And appreciate the fact that you are different and that there's a uniqueness to that. And there's an edge to it. When I say edge, you know, that whole approach of like steel sharpens steel. There's an edge to your difference. It allows you to be that differentiated person in a group, which should be appreciated, should be revered on some level.
Yeah, you don't really come to unity if you have sameness. That's just uniformity. Yeah. You have to celebrate everybody's diverse contributions in order to have true unity, because then you've built something new that comes as a result of everyone's contributions to that group.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I think to not get stuck at the ideas of we've always done it that way, because that's the way we do it. I think not only is it certainly not the best approach in any business factor, but I don't know that it always is the best approach for anybody looking to make progression.
No, it's mindless aping of the past without thinking about it. Instead of differentiating and saying, well, here are the good things and here are the things that are not so good. And here are things I'd like to change. Let's just take it all.
Yeah.
Seems very uncritical. Sorry, go ahead. What were you saying?
I was just going to say the part about the progression side is appreciating that all cultures want progression. They just want their progression. They don't want to be forced into others' progression. To be fair, that there's very few cultures that probably aren't looking for some form of a progression. They just don't want to have someone else's progression forced.
They want to be in charge of their own progression, and their own destiny,
their own
and their own future, and their own path. Yeah. I mean, nobody likes to be told what to do. So
exactly. So true.
As soon as someone says, do it my way, the first reaction is, no, don't wanna.
Yeah, that often is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even more so if somebody's telling you you're doing it the wrong way.
Yeah.
It's funny how quick that turns people to a place of, well, I'm going to reinforce doing it the way I was doing it.
Or even worse if it's, what do you know? You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we could spend a long time on that.
Yeah, I was going to say it's quickly partnered with it. Yep.
Yeah. So your indigenous culture, though, tell me what aspects of it have inspired your leadership development.
You know, I think just the story that it is for so many of us, I think that anybody that has a direct attachment still to their indigenous heritage probably understands their own family's journey and the struggles that they've had to make. That's what I look back on. The Madeline Island that is referred to in my bio, Madeline is like my great-great-great-grandmother. She's the daughter of White Crane. Oh, yeah. So, and she was married off to the French fur trader of Madeline Island, a guy named Michael Belanger. My twin brother's middle name is Belanger, and Madeline's indigenous last name was Kadot. My sister's middle name is Kadot.
Hmm. That's lovely, because it really gives a sense of place and history in family.
No? Yeah. And so, as I was going to say, it's rooted in us, and it's stuck with us. And so, the Kadot family line is certainly a family line that we all know, and that's an indigenous side of us. But the Belanger side is just as important and obviously has a root in us as well, and something that we look at as well as a family whole. And understanding that heritage of White Crane and Madeline and kind of how that has obviously brought two cultures together is interesting. My great-grandmother grew up on the Red Cliff Reservation, which is kind of around the Horn from the Bad River Reservation on the Bay of Lake Superior, basically. And so my own family's attachment to our Indigenous culture isn't that far off. My own mother likes to joke about how her grandmother spoke Ojibwe. Obviously, she grew up on the reservation, but she didn't teach it very well to anybody else. And a joke has always been, well, that's because grandma, 9 siblings, all of them who had grown up on this reservation, all of them spoke Ojibwe. Every morning they'd get on the phone and they would speak with each other, obviously in our native language. And my mom always joked about how she didn't teach it to others because they were talking trash.
Yeah, why would you want to spread the trash?
So, you know, it was always, I guess, spreading the tea or whatever you want to say about it. But and so my own grandmother would kind of have like a bitter taste sometimes about it, being like, well, you know, her mother was just on the phone and she was just talking bad about her and her brothers and sisters.
Yeah, families so can like do that really badly.
In your own culture. Yeah, but it's just fun how that becomes part of, like, it becomes part of your heritage, it becomes part of your culture. It's endearing, even though it seems strange to say it, but it's endearing that, you know, that was part of who, that's how the culture had carried down, that's how it had continued to move down. I think what gets hard for all of us then is, then we moved away from Northern Wisconsin when I was, you know, 5 years old, here to Idaho. And so from there, then the connection gets tougher, right? You have to, when you go back and visit, you try to go visit the reservation. I try to go back to the powwow. So our powwow is all centered around our ricin, Menominee, which is wild rice. And so towards the end of August, we have a powwow that's all sacred around the preparation of the harvest. And then as you probably know, in that area, then we go out and harvest wild rice. And so there's a powwow towards the end of August. And so when I can, I go out to that. So trying to stay connected to your heritage family, it's really no tougher, I think, though, for Indigenous than it is anybody that's moved away from family, that you're always trying to find a way to stay or even get back to where you come from.
Yeah. And then it's changed while you were gone.
Oh, drastically. Yeah.
Were there residential schools involved in this experience?
Yeah.
Were your family in residential schools?
Oh, no. We're all in public. My mother went to a Catholic school. And then her grandmother as well. And then my great-grandmother was educated on the reservation.
Because where I'm from here, there's a horrific legacy of residential school.
And we have that.
Abuse.
We have that within our people, but thankfully not within my own family line.
Oh, that's good. Because really, it's so damaging and takes a lot of intergenerational transformation to get past.
Yeah. And Madeline was an advocate for Indigenous rights.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That's probably what helped a little bit, or was different in my family.
Yes.
That she early on became an advocate. And there's not a lot of photos of her, but I think one of the photos is actually her in D.C. at some sort of affairs event.
Huh. This is really great that you have all of this.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Kadat family, there's actually a book. So that's what's, again, when you get lucky and blessed. And Ojibwe, which there's not a lot of like definition of like what does Ojibwe mean, but the loose definition that anybody has is like a he who writes or whatever, because we the heritage they wrote on scrolls or whatever, scripts, you know, and so part of their heritage. And so, you know, seeing how that kind of like plays into even the culture this far out is kind of interesting.
So writing, and then your dad was a journalist, you said?
He was a newspaper journalist, environmental journalist. He went to school in the 70s in Northland. Northland College was a school he went to. It was in Ashland, Wisconsin. That's how he met my mother eventually. But went and got a degree in environmental studies back in the 70s, which I always kind of joke with people because certainly knowing where the trend is around environmentalism today, that's not necessarily where, you know, that's the beginning of that movement.
And so, it was the very beginning, yeah. And now the huge backlash against taking care of our own planet, which just baffles me.
Yeah.
Why would you?
How much has changed?
Yeah. I mean, we have this environmental movement that's become so polarized, and then people on the outside are trying to say that we don't need to take care of the environment. When, how can we? It's like sitting on a branch and sawing it off and saying, I'll be fine.
Yeah. Especially when you're on the wrong side of the branch. Yeah.
Exactly.
And from an Indigenous culture perspective, you know, that's environmental factors. I would suspect, I don't know for certain, but I would suspect that almost every tribe, every nation has some fight probably from an environmental factor these days.
Yes.
Certainly within this country. I know my own is against Enbridge, which is a pipeline that runs through the middle of our reservation.
We have the same one here.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was going to say, it's a pretty big one.
Yeah.
And then here in Idaho, where I grew up, salmon are a huge factor, and we're the lifeblood of the Nez Perce. And not just the Nez Perce, but many of the indigenous of this area. And so it's not only a fight that we're all fighting from an environment factor. But interesting that, you know, I'll say my own father's career was centered heavily around trying to protect salmon.
Yeah. So that would be also indigenous approach to taking care of the stewardship of the earth. But also he was ahead of his time in terms of studying something that was not yet really understood.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really because of his own love. You know, I think that a guy that wanted probably a fishing guide is most of his life until he took on environmental right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's important because how can you take that on if you have no connection?
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. I think in the environment in general or what you, the passion for what you do in general, I think is, if there's no passion there, you'll certainly struggle to get the results.
That's for sure. So then you joined some groups. I mean, you obviously joined professional groups and you got an education and you did different things. You worked for different companies and you took on your own beliefs and interests and relationships. So from what you've brought into your own culture, from what you have something already, you have a very strong base. What have you added on culturally?
Well, I'm married. My wife is Alicia. Her name's Alicia. I say she's from Ryrie, Idaho, which if you're from Idle Falls, people know that that's the little kind of country town about 15 miles outside of Idle Falls, which is a further distance in my young childhood than it is today. But she grew up on a small cattle ranch. She's LDS, so Latter-day Saint. She's my Caucasian family, white family, which I do as well. So I give my father's that way. But and so I think, you know, from a culture perspective, like we... which, you know, I remember sitting down with her father when I asked for her hand in marriage. That was his big thing. It was a cultures coming together. And some factors, cultures clashing together.
Yes.
Because they are very different cultures.
Very different.
And yeah. Very different approaches on how we live our lives.
Mm-hmm. Did you reconcile that? I mean, obviously your father-in-law said yes, but I mean, how did you reconcile all those differences in your marriage?
We've been married 21 years. It probably took 15. you know, it's piece by piece, to be fair. I think the early stages of our marriage, we both tried to accept each other's culture as much as we possibly could.
That helps.
I converted for many years to that faith as well. I'm not a practicing member anymore, but I certainly didn't want to be a person that said no just because from the outside it didn't look like something that was comfortable to me. I didn't want to not accept my wife for who she was and where she came from. And so I think that's a big piece of anybody that's coming together is that you have to understand, like, where are those lines at? Not only for each other, but for yourself. And so those boundaries and guardrails that you're really putting into place in those early years to say, I want to be a part of as much of your life as I can, but I also want to be able to keep my own identity.
Yes.
And so it took a lot of years, not only because it's faith for anybody is a growing effort and practice. I don't know that anybody ever accomplishes it. And so that in itself its own challenges. And then from an indigenous perspective, I'll say like it's easy to put it on the back burner because it's not in front of you every day. And in those early years, as you're trying to get through each day with two babies and a new wife, but as you get to like later lives, you know, instead of a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old now, so as they're approaching like their 8 and 10-year-old lives, that's when you start to really be able to say, we've tried these things out and here's what our family needs to start looking like. Here's where our own customs are going to be.
And you create your own family identity.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you bring your cultures together. And I think that's what's really interesting is we still celebrate, obviously, a lot of the typical holidays everybody else does. And we still have a lot of that faith stuff in our family. We're very connected with my wife's family. We have Sunday dinners together often, even though there's a difference in, I'll just say, an overall like approach to religion, not necessarily in the fact of like acceptance of it, but just approach.
Have they been interested or curious about Indigenous spirituality at all?
Some. I think more from a question when it's in front of them perspective, definitely.
What about your wife?
Definitely so. Yeah, definitely. Very often. She'll always question, you know, and sometimes I don't even know. To be fair, sometimes it's challenged me to go learn more about my own culture.
Mm. Well, that's good.
Like, I don't know that. I don't know the answer to that. Or I've never heard anything about that. And so, you know, she's often has read as much as probably I have. And our big thing over the last few years has been trying to, especially for myself, even as like learn the language better. As we do that, obviously, we certainly share it with each other and we share it with our children. And
just promise me you're not going to talk trash about your relatives.
Yeah. I don't speak it well enough yet, but I only know good words.
Good.
Yeah. But often, instead of even saying hello to anybody, says bonjour, which is you know, how we say hello. And so
that's how we'd say hello in Michif here for the Métis as well.
Yeah, that Anishinaabe is the Ojibwe or descendants, and that language comes from there.
Hmm. Well, what about temperament and personality? So, you know, you're born with a certain temperament. You said to me that you're very easygoing and you go with the flow. That might be part of your temperament. And it's, of course, nurtured by your social surroundings. But then you've also got your personality, which comes out of meeting or not meeting, challenges when they come up, and opportunities or missing out on opportunities and how you deal with that. And so you add on personalities. Like you said, culture is always evolving. Faith is always evolving. Your relationships are always evolving. The same thing with personality. What would you say has evolved in your personality over the past few years?
Probably my compassion or my empathy.
Mm-hmm. Probably. You didn't have that before, or it's just deeper?
I think the social awareness that was required for either of those things to be very good certainly wasn't present as a young man. That's what's interesting about culture, right? Like I said, my indigenous side comes from my mother's side. My dad is like 50% European Irish based on one of those DNA tests you can take. And so there's certainly plenty of that in me. And so when you grow up in a community that's predominantly white, which Idaho is, certainly Southeast Idaho, and then almost everybody that you run into is also a member of the same church, your social awareness is very low. You don't need it. Everybody kind of acts the same way. You quickly learn what's out of bounds, and then it's really easy just to stay in bounds all the time. So what I tell people then is I moved out of this area because I moved to Boise, and then I went to Washington and Oregon and Texas and Florida and Kansas. That social awareness grew not only a ton, but sometimes at a drastic pace as well, as far as having to catch up or learn quickly. Just to be a strong leader or partner or even friend, because the reality was I had grown up a certain way and with certain people. And so I was oblivious to so many things from a social perspective and other people, but also within the own culture that I exist in, because things like domestic violence and mental health aren't things that we talk about very openly, and especially aren't things that we talk about in the communities I grew up.
Mm-hmm. So you developed some social awareness that you didn't have from moving around, but also the ability to talk about things that were considered taboo when you were growing up.
Yeah. And I think the other empathy factor then comes as you get to know people and how they come up and the challenges that they have to face. It certainly gives you an appreciation that we're all sometimes fighting through the day. But the other side is it allows you then to have a certain level of empathy, a certain level of understanding. And true empathy comes from that ability to put yourself in someone's shoes, not for me to just be able to tell you why I understand what it's like.
It's like, what's that like for you? I get it. I've been through the same thing. It's not the same thing as what's that like for you.
Yeah. And then to go hungry or to, I grew up with a coworker one time. He was sharing an experience where he was talking about as a young man or the boy, things would disappear in his house and didn't think anything of it. And as he got further into the story, what he was really talking about was the fact that he grew up in a home where his parent would often have to go pawn the things that were in their house to try to make ends meet. But that's why things were disappearing. I didn't grow up that way. Not that I don't probably know people that did grow up that way, but it certainly is, again, those aren't things we talk about with each other. Those aren't things that, and so as you get older and people share those experiences with you, especially as a parent, they become heavy-seated moments for you to say, like, I could only, again, empathize with somebody what that's like. I can appreciate why it would drive how you make decisions and how you look at things. And then I think from another side of it as a parent to say, how do I make sure that I'm making all the best decisions so I don't ever put my own children in a moment like that?
Mm, right. That leads me to my question about dissonance, which you already described, but I think you probably can come up with a specific example when you realize that what you know and the way you understand the world is culture specific to you, and you're in a situation where it's not the same. And it's like, wow, what just happened? It's a culture shock experience. Can you think of one in your own life? Probably many.
Oh, yeah. You know, one that stuck with me as a young boy, I did Cub Scouts, and Cub Scouts were all driven through the LDS church here when I was a kid, which didn't prevent my parents from allowing me to be a part of it. But I remember one day, I'd probably been in it a couple of years, and often the meetings were usually at someone's house, but like if they had big events, they were always in the churches. And of course, if they're going to do something in their church, there's going to be a prayer. And so my father one time was attending with me, and there was a prayer. And I'm not sure how much you know about the LDS faith, but often when they pray, they do it with their arms folded.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so because of that example over the past couple of years, when I was in their church, when they prayed, I prayed that way. And I remember my dad saying, you know, that's not necessarily the way we pray, and not understanding it very well as a young man or a young boy. I think probably early on, I thought it was just to be like, we're different. We're not them. But I also don't know that as a mid-40-year-old I am today, that I see it all at that as well. I think it was him also identifying that there's there is a divide in our culture. We went to church. We just didn't go to their church. I went to a non-denominational Christian church here in town. And of course, members of that church, when they pray, they traditionally just did it with their, you know, hands in the lap. And so it's an interesting example, but I think it was kind of one of those moments where I realized, you know, even in such a place like this, and even as a young boy, it was very clear that beyond even my indigenous side, that we were outsiders in the community that we'd come to because of the fact that we weren't part of the typical religion or the common religion.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example. So here's your chance for a soapbox moment. What would you like to promote? What would you like people to know about?
From a whole, I always tell people it centers myself on both sides to say, from a person and from a leadership perspective, I would say, like, as a manager, I'm a leader first in everything. I'm a developer. And then on the indigenous side, I get fit so well as to say, you know, from a leadership perspective as well, my big approach has always been that you leave a team or a place better than you found it. And I think that it fits well into any environmental factor. But I think it also fits into like how we should orient ourselves as we seat ourselves into the work we do every day and to the work that we do with our families. And so, you know, the message I always promote is that in itself. From a work perspective, it is about finding ways to really give back to the community. And for myself, it's why I came back to Idaho Falls, was because it put me in a place where it was the community that gave so much to me. Even though sometimes I can be a hard critic coming up in this community sometimes and being that outsider approach, I still love it. I tell everybody, you're 30 minutes from some of the best fly fishing or downhill skiing in the whole country. So it's still a very treasured place. Mm-hmm. But it won't be here long. It won't be the way it is forever if we all don't start taking action to be better engaged with it.
Totally.
From an environment factor. And I think, you know, the other side of it is that I'm not even 30 miles away from the Chauvin Reservation. And so as I got back over here and try to get back seated and grow a network, it's also trying to find ways to give back to even to that community. And so certainly in some of the early stages of getting in there, because it can be very different among each nation, each tribe, and how we look at each other. To be fair, to be a member today that doesn't live on a reservation and is just simply a card-carrying member, I do get looked at differently.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I should. They are two very different lifestyles. And so that's, you know, as you think about the what that work should look like, it's how do we continue to bridge the gaps that those lifestyles don't have to be so different.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that the opportunity, which is what diversity and inclusion and DE&I work's all about, is it's trying to even out the playing field so that the opportunity is where it needs to be for people. I'm recognizing that certainly situations are what they are, but trying to create equitability and opportunity in itself should be something that we're all putting effort on.
So important. Yeah, really important. Otherwise, we don't have a just society. And in just society always leads to corruption and disease and environmental degradation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've been pretty active on the political side as well. And not so much on the political side to say they're the right or wrong, because there's plenty of that. But more to say, the more we focus on the right versus the wrong, the less we're focused on what we need to fix, how we create solutions, how we appreciate the people that are sitting across from us, regardless of their differences in ideology, approach, culture, whatever that may look like, that no one person in this country, regardless of whether they came here on a ship or came here because they were seated here hundreds and thousands of years, deserves inequality or deserves less opportunity or certainly deserves a harder life than somebody else. And I think that sometimes like we forget that we're so focused on winning, whether it's our point, our political side, our dollar amount on our paycheck, whatever that looks like, that we forget the humanity factor that we're all surrounded.
Well, we're all human beings first, really.
Yeah. The more that we work to make sure that all of us are taken care of, the better off we'll all be.
Yes.
And I'm not saying to like, and it's not even an approach of like giving away or anything like that. It's more just about kindness and approach than it is any.
I totally agree with you. You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah. And so I think that in today's, you know, as we certainly have gone past these 4 or really 8 years, I think it's certainly been tough. I think as the angst and anxiety around things seems to just increase a lot of times. I think that's the big message that I'm really trying to get more focused on as a whole, is the seed of it all is just how do we love each other more?
Yes, exactly.
Where culture and heritage is important, we should be focused on it. But I think on the other side of it, we all need to be open to some levels of progression to say, if the progression is about creating stronger equality or stronger opportunity, then we all should be there. If it's about limiting or closing off, or only providing it for one, then we need to get away from those approaches. And the reality is it's going to take all of us to identify and get comfortable when sometimes it's not maybe most advantageous for you.
Yes. I'm saying yes to everything you just said. Very nicely articulated. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close out the interview. And also, I just want to check in that leadershipsolutionsid.com is the way to get in touch with you, or LinkedIn, Daniel Barker, MHRM. Are those the best ways to get in touch with you?
Yeah, those are definitely the best ways to get in touch with me. And I have to say, I love the opportunity to learn. These are questions we talked earlier about self-awareness, right? I think that one of my passions is emotional intelligence, which is centered around your ability to have self and social awareness. And moments like this that you had, it creates another layer of self-awareness for me, right? These are certainly things that are within me that I ponder occasionally. Some of them I have talked about. Some of them I don't know that I've thought about in a while. And so that's what's interesting as a whole for anybody is, you know, look for those moments with people that not only create opportunity to understand everybody better, but understand yourself better. I think the first stage of any successful leader is knowing yourself well.
Totally. Thank you so much, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, same here. Thank you so much for your time.
Coming from a mixed Indigenous heritage with some Scottish and Irish mixed in, Dan Barker has found a variety of inroads into belonging while keeping his sense of culture and identity intact. I was particularly interested in how he negotiated his indigeneity with the conservative Latter-day Saints community as he grew up in, even marrying into that religion. Dan's openness to others and to being a part of groups that may have felt difficult to identify with is inspiring. Paradoxically, his story of learning to play football after his father insisted that fear was not a reason to drop out set the standard for his life as an Indigenous rights and cultural awareness advocate. Here are some of the takeaways I have from my interview with Dan. 1. Cultural learning is always evolving and growing, just as culture everywhere grows and evolves. 2. Adding the family names of your diverse lineage to various children's names sets the tone for remembering that we have many cultural roots and all are valuable. 3. It is possible to love the place you came from, even if that place did not initially welcome you. 4. Fishing is a great way to connect with environmental stewardship. I really enjoyed my interview with Dan Barker, and I hope you did too. Please take the time to write a review on our podcast page, shiftworkplace.com/podcast. And there in the middle, you will see a red box that says, "We would love to hear from you," which is absolutely true. I would love to hear from you. So please write or record your review right there and you're done. Thank you so much for listening, and may culture and leadership connections continue to guide and inspire your day.